Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for August 25th, 2010. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast, and in it, as promised, I have a new segment. It's actually an inner chapter on the subject of hacker superstitions, because really, I think they have a lot more to do with our practices as hackers, the way they kind of inform and interact with those. I've also got a new hacker word of the week, and this will serve as the final reminder that there will be no new episodes on the 29th, that's a Sunday, the 1st, that's the following Wednesday, or the 5th, that's the Sunday before the Labor Day holiday, because I'll be at Dragon Con. So this is your final reminder. If you'd like to meet up, I'll be putting my schedule up soon, including some of my social commitments. I'm going to try to, after the Parsecs on Saturday after 7, I'm going to try to get over to the twit.com/swordandlaser meetup to meet some of the folks that I know that will be there. If you want to see me there, that's a good opportunity to do so. Otherwise, as always, feel free to email me at feedback@thecommandline.net. Let me know that you're going to be there and you're interested in getting together, and we'll figure something out. The other thing before I get started is I wanted to give a quick review of a book I finished recently, Neil Nettinol's Copyright's Paradox. It's an incredibly well-researched discussion of the balance between copyright and free speech. He covers both sides of this quite well. You get a strong sense of the historical shift and the key cases and events informing the narrowing of what are supposed to be the free speech safety valves built into the copyright law and body of cases. I especially like his deconstruction of the Blackstonian interpretation, that's the urge towards this this view of copyright as physical property and informed by the legal theories and conceptions around actual tangible property. Even though he's immensely critical of these copyright maximalists, he concedes well that we need a variety of media sources and business models, so it's not totally a copyright anarcho view of things. It's actually a lot more balanced than that. Like other scholars in this field, he concludes with recommendations, and I would put his suggestions right up there with the more recent work by Pamela Samuelson out of Berkeley. The book is not very long, just over 200 pages, but it is a very demanding read. A distraction from a sentence of a paragraph, for instance, can easily unravel the whole sense of it. So you want to read this book where you can dedicate the kind of focus that it deserves. It is pretty gripping, though. So if you're actually interested in the subject of copyright policy and its history and this idea, this central paradox that by kind of having limits and constraints, a limited monopoly, we can fuel free expression, then the distraction factor may not be as much of a concern. The demand the book makes on you to avoid distraction and really give it your full attention may not be that big a deal. I'm actually also very glad that I bought this book, as I ended up marking quite a few pages and highlighting passages that I want to go back to. I could easily see rereading this book on a fairly regular basis. I have one piece of listener feedback to share, the piece I didn't get to last week because of the length of the feature. This actually came in a while ago, and it's an email from Grant, who is writing in particular in response to my discussion of the World Reader. This is one of two devices being targeted at the developing world to help with access to knowledge and literacy. And he writes, "Dear Thomas, I'm a recently returned Peace Corps volunteer who served in Ghana from June 2008 to August 2010. My project area was ICT education, specifically setting up a computer lab, internet connection, and formal classes for a senior high school in Ghana, so your recent segment on the World Reader project was especially interesting to me. As you mentioned, cellular technology is very ubiquitous here. Most people have at least one phone, or at least access to one, and they run the gamut of simple Nokia phones with built-in flashlights to dual-SIM multi-touch phones with built-in TV tuners. I've even seen a few iPhones floating around. My village of 5,000 people had 5 cell phone towers alone. In my estimation, mobile telephony, and specifically smartphones, are going to be the dominant computing platform in Ghana and the rest of the developing world for the foreseeable future. Most people in Ghana choose to buy a nice mobile phone first, and a computer or other piece of technology second. The advent of projects like the 8-bit Humane Reader Computing Platform, the OLPC, or the World Reader Project, while interesting, do not have nearly the same potential for market penetration or mindshare as does an HTC phone running Android or a Nokia N910. These smartphones fit all of the necessary requirements for developing world technology: moderately rugged, portable, versatile, and low on power consumption. They also lack the hamstringing of developing world technology. That is to say, they don't have a lack of upgradability or expansion. Anyone who doubts this should try installing more RAM in an OLPC. The major reason why technology is a problem in the developing world isn't the technology itself. It's the lack of reliable infrastructure. PCs die before they get to rural Ghanaian, hopefully I said that right, villages because the roads are in poor conditions, and they don't survive in the village because the electrical grid is prone to outages and spikes. Cell phones survive that much better, and if someone really needs a computer, they can get one. Instead of developing technology solely for developing countries, the tech industry would do well to make their existing products more robust. For example, netbooks do well in Ghana for many of the same reasons I mentioned with cell phones: low power consumption, moderately rugged, and portable. If someone started manufacturing a $10 or $20 Bluetooth keyboard and mouse combo, and mobile phone manufacturers added a TV or VGA out capability to their smartphones, that would go much further in technology penetration than building a custom 8-bit computing device. That's just my 2 cents worth. I have enjoyed the podcast throughout my Peace Corps service, and thank you for your efforts. Grant, thank you so much for sending that email. I would say that that was definitely worth well more than 2 cents. I'm glad you enjoyed the podcast, and I'm especially thrilled that you decided to write and share your experiences. I think that it confirms a lot of what I've read and heard elsewhere, and I think it really frames this issue of technology in the developing world in a way that I haven't heard before exactly put that way, but in a very compelling fashion. As you say, rather than kind of crippling or dumbing down the technology that we have in the first world, in developed nations, making sure that technology everybody has passes the same sort of minimum bars in terms of accessibility, ruggedness, power consumption, and the like. Very thoughtful, very thought-provoking. Once again, thank you so much for sharing that. If you'd like to add your comments to a story, ask some questions, or share an experience, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net. The Hacker Word of the Week comes from The Jargon File, maintained by Eric Raymond at catb.org. Finger-pointing syndrome. Noun. All too frequent result of bugs, especially in new or experimental configurations. The hardware vendor points a finger at the software. The software vendor points a finger at the hardware. All the poor users get is the finger. The inner chapters journal my own quest to improve in the craft of programming. Each chapter reflects on a specific practice or principle through the lens of my own experiences, both as a professional and an enthusiast. The name refers to the Chinese classic of philosophy, the Chuanzi. Divided into 2 sections, the inner chapters make up the first part, attributed to the philosopher Chuanzi himself. The commentaries on the first section, written by his students and others, are known as the outer chapters. I hope you will contribute to my outer chapters by sharing your own thoughts and experiences on growing as a programmer. I've seen more than a few programmers who observe superstitions. These aren't usually the ones with which you're familiar, like throwing some spilled salt over your shoulder. Explaining them to non-programmers is often difficult, shrouded in personal or shared history. In form, they are often as eccentric as more common superstitious practices. At their core, I think that hacker superstitions and the more plain variety are given credence for much the same reason. Invoking them is usually done as a hedge against the unknown or the seemingly unpredictable. In the absence of something we know, they help us deal with a situation. It is useful to have something, anything to do. It assuages our need for action of some kind, even if there isn't necessarily any real effect. Most hacker juju typically has to do with personal process. There are a lot of different activities involved in assembling, releasing, and supporting programs. Programmers have a great deal of choice in specifically how they go about each and every one of those tasks. Sometimes techniques are chosen rationally, based on formal teaching or a well-argued point from a peer. Other times, they are developed seemingly at random. As much as we strive for all experiments with software tools to be undertaken with rigor and result in full understanding, many times hackers arrive at a formula that works solely by trial and error. Tools for building software often come with a bewildering array of options. There isn't always the time needed to explore them exhaustively. Documentation is sometimes incomplete, leaving correct usage up to guesswork. There are plenty of cracks and bad joints through which irrational beliefs can seep into daily routine. One former coworker described his update build commit cycle as a superstitious practice. He never committed a change to source control without pulling fresh updates followed by a full compile. This all had to be executed within a limited window, in the order of minutes. If he sat too long after updating or compiling, then his local copy might be too stale versus the server copy. Bear in mind that he was usually the only committer against that particular server. All the same, if he failed, his irrational fear was he'd commit a change that broke the build for someone else. This is a slightly more rational impulse than most, although it is a bit odd. In soliciting help with this feature, an online acquaintance related the compulsion to ensure source code comments are all symmetrical. At first, I'll admit I wasn't entirely sure how this qualified as superstitious. When I pressed, he explained how he felt that not tending to comment symmetry might hide a real problem with matching up braces and parentheses in the code. Even though the two are not necessarily related, and a good editor or IDE can match up actual structural symbols like braces, he still clings to his need to keep comments arranged just so. He also very honestly shared that he is OCD, a malady I suspect is common amongst hackers and programmers. Neuroses that lead to fastidiousness like this can actually be an advantage at the expense of perhaps some wasted motion in the activity of coding. It's far too easy for the weakest link in producing software, the hacker, to fail. The anecdotes about personal process highlight this really well. It isn't necessarily ignorance of what the software is doing that is the problem. Making a mistake in processing is all too easy. In the source control example, getting distracted before a commit can make it easy to forget whether your local source is up to date or that you have indeed performed a good compile. A little wasted motion in following a superstition can save a lot of waste if a mistake is allowed to occur, especially in a team environment where the impact on other contributors acts as a force multiplier on top of the mistake. Breaking the build is invariably traceable back to a simple goof by someone. Fear of stalling the whole team can lead to some constructive habits that aren't necessarily rationally tied to the real scope of the risk. If we assess the likelihood of a mistake occurring, say by looking at some historical data on build breaks, we'd most likely realize it doesn't happen all that often. Worrying about causing breaks can incur some intangible costs that might erode a healthy team dynamic or sap momentum in a small but noticeable way. Having a juju, as irrational as it may be, can bring a counterintuitive benefit here. The example of the comments and braces is similar. With modern tools, the probability of an uncaught, unbalanced brace is low. Even when it does happen, all the syntax, highlighting, and language support usually makes short work of tracking down the problem. Anxiety about making this mistake can rob momentum. The person who shared the story has found a way here to harness his OCD, that anxiety, to be able to spend small effort to avoid some larger worry that might actually hamper his work. The unpredictable is pretty much the everyday with software. According to the dictionary, superstition is informed by belief in supernatural causes. There isn't anything supernatural in software. in the conventional sense. If you cannot easily apprehend the cause of something you're seeing, though, it is easy enough to assign it to something like the supernatural. Many non-programmers have a view of coding as being like math. All variables and the course of putting together a program have to be accounted for. If it's a giant equation or proof, then everything has to be accounted for and explained. For trivially small programs, that may actually be possible. When a program grows to a size where it does something truly useful, it is next to impossible for one person to be able to fully quantify everything that it does at every moment when it is running. This is a pretty simple debunking of this too close equation of programming to mathematics, which more people might be familiar with. Worse, software is a complex phenomenon. There isn't a one-to-one ratio between those variables in a geometric proof and the outcome. A bigger program isn't just more of the same, more variables, more conditions, with the problem of understanding being that you just have to remember more states and instructions. More source code really is different than a smaller amount. There is more opportunity for non-local effects to arise, like variables in broader scopes, not even global, but just broader, affecting ones in narrower scopes, or state inside some shared object or library being unexpectedly changed. When you throw any kind of parallelism into the mix, it gets that much worse. It isn't even necessary that you are explicitly working with parallel code, usually in the form of threads, but sometimes also processes more heavyweight or using newer ideas like coroutines. By their very nature, many programs are already inherently parallel. This is true for server applications of all kinds, such as web applications, which are becoming the most common and should be pretty familiar to most of you listening who actually do program for whatever reason. Multiple users don't ask servers to do work in an orderly fashion, and wouldn't tolerate the work they are trying to do being queued up so the server could do just one thing at a time. Imagine how much worse Twitter would fail if every time you posted a tweet, you received a note like a customer service call queue. Your tweet is important to us and will be posted in the order received. There are 1,317,242 tweets ahead of yours in the queue. That means that there are legitimate sources of ignorance, code pathways outside of our ability to easily understand them. It makes sense that some hackers would think of these blind spots as something akin to the supernatural then, where the natural equates to what we can understand and what we can easily account for. All of this can lead to a couple of funnier and more frustrating at the same time superstitions. Failing to reproduce a problem when the developer is present can lead to a semi-serious belief that the developer scares away the problem, or emits some sort of bug suppression field. Oddly enough, the other explanation for this particular supernormal situation relates to science, not superstition. I've heard the term Heisenbug. I've even used it myself. The idea is that the developer's observation of the bug changes its behavior, like the effect of observation on quantum mechanical systems, or the inability to measure both speed and position at the same time. In my experience, there is something to the idea of viewing, the act of it, perturbing a system. It isn't that the code is changed, however. Unconsciously, even the most savvy user may change what they do to reproduce a particular bug when a troubleshooter is present. In this day of browser-fronted applications, just hit refresh is not an uncommon mantra. Sergio Teoduke on Identica pointed out how repetition of a bug often clears it up without anything explicitly changing. I've seen some systems where such bugs are never solved. Users just develop the habit, or superstition, of repeating some task. This is likely a consequence of some contention between parallel requests. The times a particular bug pops up is when two or more users are hitting the same stretch of code or two conflicting parts. Even if both users are giving in to the mistaken belief that repeating will make the bug go away, running that same function over increases the odds that the time between the two executions hitting that trouble spot that second time through is wide enough for one or both users to slip through, avoiding the error on subsequent tries. These race conditions can be ridiculously difficult to solve, even under the best circumstances, when you can reproduce it with a minimum number of users and control very carefully the timing of all of them. In my experience, these sorts of bugs are slow to solve. If you pay very close attention, increasing or improving logging, you might get a bit more of the puzzle as time goes on. I've met very few people who can reason out race conditions in their head or even on a whiteboard. But most people are capable of finding counterexamples that deflate a proposed explanation, a rational explanation, of the necessary sequence of events to cause them. This is a case where a fix is genuinely needed, where more information can eventually help refine belief enough to lead to that solution. Most of the time when I've gone through this, I'd say we got very close to the actual sequence of execution, but never all the way towards pinning it completely down. Solutions can often be coarse enough that some residual ignorance or misbelief can still linger and not present any more of a problem than it did originally. Ironically enough, debunking a superstition can sometimes make things far worse. If the belief really is irrational, but the resulting action is harmless, or in that latter case that I describe, oddly beneficial, then there is little harm in letting superstitions persist amongst users and even hackers. Think about pseudoscience for a minute. It's a bit of a flawed comparison, I know, but where some correct knowledge mixed with some incorrect knowledge leads to utter wackiness. Our minds are really good at recognizing patterns and correlations. They are not so good at rigorously testing for correct causation. If the correct portion of technical knowledge relates to some easy-to-break part of a system, you could see a developer or user making changes, thinking they had a good grasp of the system, but in reality, breaking things far worse because of that mixture of knowledge and ignorance and that belief that they've got a good grasp on the totality. If the same person lacked that bit of knowledge and had some practice or technique that appeared to work, they might be less tempted to try to reason through doing something more or different. They would be more comfortable remaining entirely in ignorance of how the underlying system worked. And I'm not saying ignorance is an unalloyed good. I'm talking about relatives here. That would be very elitist for me to say that it's an absolute, that a junior developer shouldn't have any understanding. A little bit of knowledge is dangerous. I'm just talking about this very specific case here where it can be a risk. I hope you understand what it is that I'm trying to get at. Rather, I think it would be fairer to say incompletely debunking a superstition can be more dangerous than leaving well enough alone. I would say this is most true when the time and effort to educate maybe is more than can be afforded at that particular time. This was certainly more common in my experience when I worked in support versus programming. Out of good intentions, I'd try to explain some program or peripheral to a clearly superstitious user who drove the software or device just so. They got the end result they wanted. They didn't know how it worked. They didn't care. It was just the result that mattered to them. Unfortunately, there was never time to completely explain things. There was always pressure to close tickets, to move on after solving a particular problem. You could never spend a whole afternoon improving someone's literacy to the point where they really understood things. Leaving them with an incomplete understanding then, and maybe inflating their sense of what they knew beyond what they really do know, often led to more support calls from that user than just letting them do and think as they had in the first place, do the thing that worked for them, even though maybe it wasn't entirely correct or rational. There is often a strong overlap amongst hackers between ritual and superstition. I distinguish these two by the level of awareness as well as the intent to which they're applied. When I spoke about rituals in an earlier inner chapter, I was describing practice that helps support work in an explicit and positively reinforcing way. Practicing a ritual is usually rational, designed to improve an aspect of our practice of hacking. When a ritual does not have a rational basis, it rarely introduces any kind of risk to the work we do. And a rational ritual may still have a sound basis, say an emotional one, but the intent is always conscious and towards the good. Exercises that simply boost mood can have a positive knock-on effect, making us more attentive, patient, and generally ready to tackle challenges. Again, they don't have to have a purely intellectual basis. Doing them incorrectly may fail to lift our spirits, but it won't break a build. Superstitions are often more immediate, more intertwined with the actual work at hand, the way we interact with source control, or the particular build steps we invoke, how we drive peripherals to run a print job or calculate some pivot table, are as commonly informed by superstition as having thought things through from first principles, considering all the possible side effects in the most correct way to proceed. They may be harmless. In some cases, observing them or not really makes no difference on the outcome of a particular bit of work. But there are also the cases where they can directly impact some aspect of building software or getting something done as much for the bad as for the good. It's worth thinking about our personal superstitions. It isn't necessary to eliminate them or even shift them onto a more reasoned footing. Understanding the potential risks is enough to ensure that we trim out those that may be harmful and only leave behind to observe the ones that at worst have no effect, but in the observation may help lighten the cognitive load, the considerable cognitive load incurred by managing the inherent complexity and hacking together software. I know that there are many more examples of hacker superstitions and probably as many explanations behind them, both rational and irrational. If you have your own and feel compelled to share, I'm happy to receive them as always, as long as I can share them with everyone else. You can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net. Theme music is The Wicked Thoughts of You by Tafubar, remixed by Mo Shang for the album Asian Variations. For more information, visit asianvariations.com. This music used under permissions of a Creative Commons music sharing license. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoy the program, please do tell a friend, or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all of the different ways you can help financially support the program. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to post a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/gnupg-fingerprints. The next episode will probably go up September 8th, that's the Wednesday after Labor Day when I return from Dragon Con, and if it does, it will most likely feature some of the audio from that very event. So until either then or the Sunday following, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank Liberated Syndication and Wouta DB for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is made from 100% recycled bits. Permission to recycle those further, except where noted, is granted under a Creative Commons Attribution Sharealike 3.0 United States license. That means you can do what you like with the content as long as you tell folks where you got it and you share your changes under the same terms.